Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Let's talk to Michael Miller right now. He's an associate professor of economics at DePaul. Frequently visits with us, particularly on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Michael, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing real well, John. I'm going to talk about something quite interesting to economists.
Well, and I think to all of us, or maybe at least a little confusing to all of us. And so then I see this video somebody sent me from a woman who goes by the name Politics Girl. Her name is Lee McGowan. She comes from a liberal point of view. She was explaining to us all the dangers of and the history of the debt ceiling in a really tight little video. But I thought, I don't know if I should take this as gospel. You're not a liberal economist, are you, Michael?
No, I'm a conservative.
Okay, so
proudly. Then
why don't you walk me through this. I'm going to play some cuts. You tell me up or down, true or false. This is where the politics girl says that this is how these deals are done.
The new Republican House is going to cause this country a lot of problems. But the biggest crisis right off the top is going to be raising the debt ceiling. Because Kevin McCarthy made a private agreement with the Freedom Caucus in order to secure their votes for his leadership. He promised them that there would be no vote to lift the debt ceiling without the Biden administration agreeing to major spending cuts, which, to be clear, is going to be a complete non-starter for the White House and the Democratic Senate because the spending has already been approved by Congress. These are done deals.
Is that true, Michael? The spending we're talking about is for things that we've already essentially purchased?
It's part of what we already have budgeted. So she is correct that there was an agreement between the House, the Senate, and the President to spend X number of dollars. But, you know, no Congress is held hostage by a previous Congress. So there's no reason why this Congress cannot say, well, given current conditions, we need to reconsider the budget.
Here's cut number two, restating just kind of where we are right now.
The term raising the debt ceiling is confusing because it implies we want to spend more money when actually we're just agreeing to pay the bills we've already rung up.
Which is the point I was trying to make a minute ago. That and while that is true, you're saying that the Congress could do something about that?
Oh, sure. I mean, let's say your family, you know, you have a budget and it's based upon two people in the household working. What if one loses their job? Would you continue to spend the same amount of money?
No,
when you have us. No, of course you wouldn't.
No. But what she's saying is that we bought some groceries last week and we have to, you know, we used electricity last week and now we have to pay the electric bill. That's what she's saying this represents.
If that's what she's saying, then that's correct. But see, I think it's more that in the coming year, we're going to spend more money and it has already been budgeted. But we don't have enough money coming in to pay for that for those expenses. I think the concern is not with what has happened in the past. It's more a concern of what's coming up to the future.
But the debt ceiling, well, let's listen more to what she says. Here's her short history of the debt ceiling.
Like any of us, governments have to borrow money when they spend more than they receive. They do this by issuing bonds, which are basically IOUs for the money to be repaid. Government debt is the total sum of borrowed money. The debt ceiling, which FYI most countries don't have, was established more than 100 years ago when Congress passed a law to allow the country's debt to roll over without needing additional congressional approval every time. It was done so that then-President Woodrow Wilson could have access to the money he needed to fight World War I without having to wait for lawmakers to meet and debate and vote on whether he could have the money.
Didn't know that. Is that about right?
Yeah, when you first sent me this this clip, I said, I think she does a decent job. It's just the name calling, and there's some difference interpretation as to what the intentions are and why the Republicans, in a sense, are fighting back.
Here's just the last chapter of her short history of the debt ceiling.
Okay.
They weren't flying places or sending emails or chatting on the phone. This was like snail mail Model T Ford days. And when you're fighting a war, time is of the essence. So Congress created a way for the president and his party to borrow money without requiring congressional approval. But they put a limit on how much money could be borrowed, so they weren't just giving the president a blank check. The debt ceiling is that limit.
Is that pretty fair and accurate?
Yeah, that is spot on. But do we remember that the founding fathers gave the power of the purse to the House of Representatives? And now we have, you know, newer ways in which we can move more quickly, and we don't have to worry about horse and buggy or taking the train. We can do things instantly.
I'm going to pause here, and when we come back, then she gets to the consequences of all of this. But it still seems to me as though one point of departure for you and I right now, you and me right now, is that I imagine that what we're talking about here is paying for services or goods that we have already essentially used or purchased, and now we have to raise the debt ceiling, borrow more money to accommodate those already used expenses. That seems to be pretty clear to me in all of this so far, Michael.
I see that we have purchased some things, but then we have to purchase some more, because the whole idea of adding to the debt is that we have to borrow going forward. And we have to borrow going forward because we're spending more than we're taking in the current and in the future period. So I guess we're seeing it from different time periods. Certainly, if you've already bought something, you should pay for it. But
wouldn't the debt ceiling accommodate that? We do need to raise the debt ceiling to pay for those old purchases, right?
Absolutely. And I will state clearly that I am not a fan at all of having this debt ceiling battle time after time after time. I wish we could get rid of it completely. It's just that when you look at her arguments, could there be a reason why the Republicans are fighting so hard against are trying to get some concessions from the president on the future direction of spending? And I think there's more to be said than she gives credit for.
Michael Miller is an associate professor of economics at DePaul, a frequent guest on our Wintrust Business Lunch and some of our other shows here. And I asked him to come on today to sort of break down this Lee McGowan video. She goes as the politics girl on the internet and posts videos and is talking about issues. I thought she had an interesting explanation of this debt ceiling crisis and what should or should not be done, but I don't want to take her word for it. I rather trust Michael Miller. So she just gave us, Mike, a history of the debt ceiling. Here's a cut where she talks, Pete, I think we're on cut 5 now, right? The consequences of all of this.
Raising the debt ceiling means passing a law to raise the current limit the Treasury Department can borrow to pay its bills. Bills for things that have already been approved. Without raising the debt ceiling, America will run out of money. And if we run out of money, we default on our loans. And just like a regular person, if we default on our loans, we trash our credit standing, which would cause the markets to destabilize. And if the American market destabilizes, it has a ricochet effect on the global markets, potentially putting the entire world economy at risk. Not to mention that millions of people are employed by the federal government. If we run out of money, none of these people can get paid, and they lose their livelihoods overnight.
How about that, Mike?
Well, I only have one quibble with it. We will not run out of money. We will simply run out of the ability to borrow money above and beyond what we've already borrowed. The federal government has money coming in every single day. And if it had to, it could always take whatever money it is getting and pay the interest on the debt, and therefore it would never default. I do not think for one second that the federal government will ever default. No one would be that stupid. And her consequences are correct. If we were to be so stupid, it would be a disaster, an absolute disaster.
But it's not that
we don't have money. It's that we can't borrow extra money.
Do we have people in the Congress that are so stupid, your word, or stubborn, so ideological that they would do something that foolish?
There may be a few. I would hope that they would be marginalized and we wouldn't even listen to them. I think the leadership on both sides would never let this happen.
Here's cut number 6, and this is a point you were trying to make a moment ago.
Now, this is clearly a very serious problem, but it's also an entirely self-inflicted one, because Congress could just vote to remove the debt ceiling entirely and take this arbitrary limit off our borrowing. The debt ceiling leaves us vulnerable. So we keep finding ourselves in a position where we can crash the world's economy, but we don't vote to remove it because enough people want to keep the option of holding the government hostage as a bargaining chip to get what they want.
What do you make of that statement, Mike?
Yeah, I think that is why the politicians, if I have only one tool to get you to the bargaining table, Say you're the one in power, like we have Mr. Biden and the Senate are both controlled, are both Democrats. The only way the Republicans or the Democrats could have any power in that situation is to have something like this debt limit as a cudgel to bring people to the negotiating table. So I get it from a political standpoint. I don't like it from an economic, but from a political standpoint, I think that's why they will not pass an act to get rid of this whole idea.
She says, however, that it's not the Democrats that do it. It's always the Republicans.
The Republicans want to keep the option to hold the government hostage to get what they want. And that's not me just being a liberal saying that. That's the facts. We already had a debt ceiling crisis during the first year of Biden's presidency because the Republicans didn't want to pay for deals that were made under the Trump presidency now that Biden was left in charge. We had a major debt ceiling crisis during Obama's first term after George W. put an entire war on the government credit card and then the Republicans refused to pay for it when the Democrats got back in charge. Obama ended up having to make a ridiculous amount of concessions to his health care bill just to save the country from default. And here we are again.
Michael, what's your thought about all that?
Well, two pieces. One, of course, she mentions about Mr. Obama having to give concessions. Well, that was the whole idea of negotiation. You can't always have everything that you want. But it is interesting, and I didn't know the history of this either. It does appear to me, just in my own memory, that the Republicans are the ones who generally bring this up. But I Googled, is that the case? And my understanding is during the George W. Bush administration, there were needs to increase it, and essentially the Democrats would not vote for it. The Republicans were able to get only a couple of Democrats, which was necessary to pass it. So Democrats have been ones who have stood on the sideline and said, I'm not going to vote for this increase. It has happened, but it's predominantly a Republican political action.
She says this about Donald Trump and Barack Obama.
Republicans raised the debt ceiling three times during Trump's presidency to pay for, among other things, the extraordinary tax cuts Republicans gave major corporations and the ultra-rich. The Democrats hated that legislation, but they didn't hold the health of the American economy and its people hostage to try and get it repealed. They voted with the Republicans to pay for what Congress had agreed to pay for. Paying our debt shouldn't be up for debate.
You know, it seems to me if you say, here's what Donald Trump did, or here's what Barack Obama did, or here's what Bill Clinton did, it was Clinton's term that we, for once, were on the positive side of this sort of thing at the end of his term, and then it went to hell after that. But it seems to me like these guys get more credit and more blame than they deserve. If you said, for instance, that we ran the credit card too much during Donald Trump's term, of course we did. We were trying to pay people during the pandemic.
So exactly the case.
They all strike me as singular instances. I suppose there are historic trends, but I think it's almost too easy to make the sweeping statements that she is there.
Yeah, I agree with you. There is one other thing is that I know there were tax cuts during the Trump administration. A lot of people had argued that our corporate tax was too high. It made us non-competitive compared to other countries. The revenue coming from the corporate tax is rose. And we have more tax revenue today than we have ever had in the history of the country. So, you know, to many Republicans, the issue here is not a taxing issue. The issue here is a spending issue.
I don't think anybody would argue with the last half of that statement, but I also think plenty of people think that the rich aren't paying enough, the companies aren't paying enough, that we may have more revenue now than ever. Evidently, it's not enough, but that doesn't mean that those people aren't paying their fair share. You have a comment on that, Michael?
Well, I can tell you, think of the countries that have that are capitalist, like Scandinavia, but they have very extensive welfare states. They take care of their people in many, many different ways. In every single one of those cases, the income tax on the middle class is substantially higher than in the United States. The only way you can possibly have enough money to have an expanded welfare state like they do there is for everyone to pay a lot of taxes, not just the rich. And it's mainly because there simply is not enough money among the rich to pay for such.
Yeah. I understand that. Let me pause you here. I got one last cut. We are out of time, but let's just take the time to do this. This is an issue near and dear to many of our listeners.
The Republicans are out here trying to argue that this is just about prioritization. They are promising to protect Social Security and Medicare payments. Not the programs themselves, mind you. Those are two of the things they want Democrats to agree to cut. But the current payments that are being made.
Will Medicare get chopped as a result of this? Social Security payments? What's the future for those?
I saw an interview with McCarthy, the speaker, Mr. McCarthy, and he was asked point blank, are you going to touch current spending on Medicare and Social Security payouts? And the answer is absolutely not. But we must all recognize that both Social Security and Medicare are going to fail starting in the 2030s. It's a demographic and economic certainty that's the case. And the sooner that we try to do something about the demographic problem or to solve this problem, the easier it will be to solve it.
I always enjoy your sober and intelligent insight into these things, Michael. I really appreciate you giving us some time this morning.
Oh, John, it's my pleasure, partly because you're always so well prepared. This is a great conversation.